from LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Sprinkle Sparkle contains adult themes and may not be suitable for all ages.
Access to pleasure and indulgence is our right, and we're entitled to it. It's not a favor that somebody's granting us. It's not a reward. It's just like why we're here. My hope is that people will listen to this and relate, even in the ugly parts, because there's something sparkling about that too.
This is Sprinkle Sparkle Podcast, and I'm Nubia Bennett. And today we are speaking with the Dr. Kyla Story.
Well, I'm excited to be here talking with you today. I'm Kyla Story. I'm an associate professor at the University of Louisville. I teach in Pan-African Studies and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies there. I've been there for about 13 years now. I became one of the pleasure ninjas, the academic Black feminist group that Joan Morgan started while she was a visiting professor at Stanford several years ago. And we, as a Black feminist collective who have a variety of research interests, wanted to create a theoretical intervention in Black feminist theory that accounted for conceptions of pleasure, and specifically looking at Black women and pleasure outside of colonized enslavement type prisms, which often dictated that sexuality for Black women especially was a space of harm, of control, of racism, of sexism, and all of those types of things. And so the intervention is an attempt to start a conversation around how we can talk about Black women and a pleasure praxis and the various pleasure practices they do and engage in without putting that lens of colonialism and white supremacy and those things, right? To talk about Black women and how they exercise agency in igniting pleasure in their lives.
I also wanted to note that this episode is dedicated to the memory of her dad, Dr. Ralph Story, who we lost this year. I just wanted to take a moment to make sure that we acknowledged the original Doc Story, because without him, we would not have the pleasure of the brilliance of the other original Doc Story. And of course, which leads me into why we're talking to Kyla today. She is the reason. I say it in the interview. She's the reason I started this journey of curiosity into what pleasure meant or means to Black women. In the first 5 minutes of this conversation, I think, is the thesis statement of this entire show. I knew that if I did a season or part of a season or anything about what it means to explore the relationship of pleasure and Black women and anybody across the gender spectrum, of color, of any level of marginalization, I could not start this conversation without her brilliant work and her brilliant insight, because she is one of the original pleasure ninjas, which we'll learn more about in just a few moments. So without any further ado, I'll just go ahead and get right into it because there's nothing else that needs to be said.
Words matter, right? And when I say that word, when I say the word pleasure, what does that word mean to you?
pleasure to me refers to all those things that in my life on how to access joy, happiness, excitement, outside of the simultaneous recognition of my own oppression as a Black queer woman. And so because of those intersections of Blackness and queerness and me being a woman and having to combat misogyny, homophobia, you know, racism endlessly, countlessly, continuously, all the time, I've been very intentional about trying to access avenues of pleasure as much as I can, whether that be through teaching. That's one of my pleasure practices. I love teaching. I love watching drag. That's another, I mean, to the point where I ended up marrying a drag king, right? That's with drag and that freedom of expression, that queer and non-binary and trans bodies, you know, ignite and put on display in this really irreverent, joyous, festive type of way. So that's another kind of pleasure praxis. And then also hanging with my academic homegirl crew. And that's been hard since COVID and we haven't been traveling as much, but you know, as a collective, we traveled to Italy, we've been to Minnesota, you know, all under the auspices of like speaking about pleasure in Black women's lives and so on and so forth. But at the same time, we've made those kind of work trips, quote unquote, really, really fun, where we explore the cities we're in, where we dine at really fabulous restaurants and use up the per diem, you know, that our universities bestow on us. We call that feminist math, you know, Black feminist math, you know, those types of things. So my newest and latest pleasure has been spending really a lot of time with my puppy. I recognize how pleasurable a relationship to an animal could be. I lived in apartments all my life, so I never got to have that kind of animal puppy love. So now I'm like completely obsessed, like everything that my puppy does, I'm like fascinated and excited, but it creates a lot of joy in my everyday and day-to-day life. And I think that for Black women especially, and a Black queer woman like myself, I think accessing avenues of joy consistently and routinely really help the flip side of miring through microaggressions and antagonism in a variety of spaces. And so you're bombarded with that kind of deflating interaction routinely, daily, as someone who's minoritized in any kind of way. And so instead of being like downtrodden and overwhelmed, and you know, of course there are times when I feel that way, but for the most part, my life is pretty pleasurable, and I really intentionally try to recreate that pleasure over and over again all the time. So I have a joyous life despite all of the kind of racist, sexist, homophobic confines that seek to define my life and seek to limit pleasure in my I see it as direct resistance to those things.
Then what's been your relationship to pleasure over time though? Have you just come out the womb like, yo, this is the way for me? Like, I mean, has that always been the way you've been, or is that something that you had to learn? And if so, how did you learn that?
Well, yeah, I feel like as a kid and as a young person, I've always been fun-filled, festive. Both my parents were very carefree spirits. They're still carefree even as seniors. And so they really made sure that I had a carefree childhood. I had a carefree upbringing where I didn't, they made me familiar with racism very early on. They made me familiar with racist images, derogatory images of Blackness, derogatory images of womanhood. You know, they clued me in on those things early on. I used to want to read Richard Wright because my dad was such a fan. He was an English professor, so he was such a fan of Richard Wright's work, but he always told me, you know, you can read Wright, but first I want you to read Alice Walker. First, I want you to read Toni Morrison. First, I want you to read Gail Jones. Like, so he was very intentional on introducing me to literary figures in novels by Black authors and by Black women that were robust and three-dimensional and that were unconventional. And he thought Wright wrote Black women in very flat, one-dimensional ways. And so even though he loved and relished his work and what for him as a Black man, it did. He felt like me as his Black daughter, that's not what I needed to think of when I was thinking about growing up and becoming a woman. He wanted me to deal with complex characters and those things. And my mom used media as a kind of teaching tool for me. So we would watch things like Women of Rooster Place, Color Purple, Imitation Alive, like, and that was her way of introducing me to really hard subject matter through something that now as an adult has become very pleasurable for me. My favorite thing to do is watch movies or binge watch television shows. Like, I find immense pleasure in kind of retreating from intellectual academic life and watching media, even though I still treat media as a thing that
I deconstruct. You got a whole podcast about it.
I analyze it and I deconstruct it. I'm into media literacy and how to interpret media and stuff like that. And so, but those things that seem to be very hard lessons, they made them interesting and fun and accessible to me as a kid. And I think that as I've grown up and become a professor, that's what I try to do with students. So at the same time, we talk about the harsh realities of racism. You know, in a lot of my courses, we make fun of racists. We make fun of, you know, homophobes and how absurd those notions are, like how absurd it is to be homophobic or sexist. And like the, you know, just the absurdity, the irony that's involved with those kind of thought processes. So it has been something that's been forever. It's not until I get, and even when I'm in college and stuff like that, it's not really until I meet Joan and then I meet Treva and Brittany, and I had known Yaba already in grad school, and we all kind of got together, and we had gotten together in 2012 at this conference. It was a Woman of Power conference, and Chantrell P. Lewis actually knew all of us in separate ways. And she kind of convened this conference, which was about Black and Latinx folk and people who identified as women, specifically talking about empowerment and justice. And right, so this was immediately after the acquittal of George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. And so we all met up in New York, and that was my first time meeting Joan. I had read Joan's work, her Chicken Heads book, in college, and it just was like a revelation. And even though she's like, no, we're friends, I just don't, I'm so uncomfortable with that notion. And I do, I see us as friends, but I also still, she's still a hero of mine, a mentor of mine. So when we all met up and talked about the limitations of Black feminist theory, in the sense that Black feminist theory forever had concentrated on the social political harm that Black women faced living in a race and sexist country, but it limited its conversations around sexuality, sex, namely. And when it did engage these things, it tended to border on respectability politics, or they were really kind of heteronormative deconstructions of sex and desire. And we, as a collective, felt like that was problematic. I mean, one, we weren't the same Black feminist theorists who were introduced to feminism in the ways that, you know, these foremothers had articulated Black feminism to be. And this is what makes Joan's book, Chickenhead, such a huge intervention. I mean, her book is the kind of one of the first to intersect Black feminist theory with a love and adoration of hip hop, and how we can love hip hop and we can still deconstruct it for the harm that the Black subjectivities. And so we all just started talking about that. We all started talking about those things. And so when Joan got her visiting assistantship at Stanford, then she invited all of us there. And we lived in this little house for a week. And we talked about Black women, pleasure, and Black feminism. And we had this round table at Stanford where we're really trying and testing out these ideas. We wanted Black feminist theory to move beyond heteronormativity. We wanted it to move beyond colonialism, beyond enslavement, beyond viewing Black female subjectivities as acted upon. We wanted to re-articulate that Black women and Black feminists, namely, had agency in constructing their lives and living their lives, and what that agency looked like, and what that pleasure looked like. You know, I mean, within Joan Morgan's book, Chickenheads, when chickenheads come home to roost, she talked about how she was this feminist and how she was raising the son to be a feminist, and how she was demanding these Black men who were misogynists around her to be feminist allies as well. But at the same time, she didn't want to fix her car, and she didn't want to take out no I mean, she didn't want to kill no bugs in her house. She wanted to be able to get dressed up in a red outfit and some pumps, and wanted people to look at her. And mm-hmm. and so that was a conversation about inviting the gaze, as opposed to most Black feminist conversations around white supremacist capitalist gaze of Black bodies, specifically Black women's bodies. What does it mean for you to be a Black feminist, know all that history, be familiar with that, and still invite a gaze upon yourself? Is that not you exercising your own agency? Mm-hmm. Is that not you articulating, this is the way my erotic map works, that I desire a gaze, I desire people to look at me, right? Because, I mean, she mm-hmm. said, you know, how absurd is it for you to get all dressed up, you smelling all good, you got all this nice outfit on, and don't nobody say nothing, right? Right, so with this middle part of not, we don't want to be harassed on the street. We don't want to be catcalled, but we definitely want to be looked at. We don't want to be looked at through the white supremacist lenses, but we want to be looked at and admired in some way that's empowering to us. And what if we find empowerment in that kind of lens? And what if we mm-hmm. find desire in that? So there's all those kinds of things that we just started talking about and going around in different parts of the world talking about.
After having that class and, you know, being in your space and reading Chicken Heads, right? Because as you were saying it, I remember there was this quote that I actually used on like my social media profile from Joan Morgan that was saying, like, I can't, like basically holding multiple things at once, right? Because I'm also raising a feminist Black son, right? That's like Black boy joy, Black person joy, however you identify, you tell me, be joyful and love the people that raised you in general as, yes, anyway. But as she put that in the book, the quote was like holding multiple things at once.
That's like how that, you know, being looked at, being gazed upon, how that in and of itself is a form of resistance. Black women are not allowed to confidently and out loud declare themselves as either bosses or forces to be reckoned with. Like Beyonce, when she's saying, I'm feeling myself, or I'm the shit, I want everybody to feel like this, folks feel like, well, that's arrogant, or mm-hmm. that's, you know, or, and then Rihanna, by in that same vein, where she says, you know, lick my cocky fresh, like in the sense that I, as a woman, am allowed to be cocky. I'm allowed to be confident. And that confidence can literally reside from any avenue of my life. It can reside from my brain. It can reside from my artistry. It can reside from my aesthetic, whatever I see as, you know, my own form of resistance. And I think that Black women rarely get to celebrate themselves in those ways because of all of these racial and sexist prisms that are operating simultaneously at the same time. So if there's this longstanding colonial legacy that's from colonization, and it's also from enslavement, that says that Black men are hypersexual, immoral, readily available, you know, that Black women in a lot of ways wanted to counter that perception, to be comfortable in showcasing yourself as a Black woman in any way you see fit, in any way that is comfortable for you, right? Mm-hmm. So you might not be comfortable showing skin or wearing bold colors, but you embrace the Black woman next to you who finds her confidence in that. And you might find confidence in another realm, right? But to celebrate all those ways that we as individual subjectivities access pleasure, joy, and power. And that we can come to these places of empowerment, and they can be diverse and varied and multifaceted. It's not just, you know, because I think that sometimes when we say pleasure praxis or the pleasure ninjas, it's just like sex, 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 or mm-hmm. showing, you know, as I mentioned, like for me, teaching is a pleasurable thing to me. I know it's mm-hmm. and I talk about it being a labor too, and it's exhausting. Like the other day, I've been teaching now at the college level for 20 something years now. I still get those moments where I feel completely overwhelmed and joyous at the aha moments in my students' faces, that it's still not old to me.
When I think about the relationship with other Black women, and how do you see that there is, like, I don't want to say an awakening because I don't want to oversimplify it, but I feel like it's happening in a lot of spaces because people don't have energy to anymore because the pandemic, maybe, to just like be tired. I think we got tired of being tired. Like, I'm tired and I want to feel good. And it's a couple things can be true at one time where I guess it's a lot of things. You just gave me a lot. So you got to give me a second. But I'm thinking about us being able to hold space for that complexity, right? Because I'm thinking about how you said that your parents, your dad specifically, was like, you need Black writers. You need to see the fullness of humanity in Black women. And that's the gift then. And you're doing that. I think your gift is even that you're giving that to basically whoever graces your classroom, whoever listens to your podcast, whoever engages with you, because of course this conversation is going to come up in your conversation because you're living and breathing that pleasure all the time. And you got those tools. Whereas a lot of folks that I've been talking to have been saying that maybe they were disconnected early and then they reconnected with it much later. Was there a person other than your parents that embodied that for you? Or did you see a person before you met the Pleasure Ninjas, or maybe that was then, that literally, whether they had words for it or not, embodied that for you?
Yeah, like along the way, I always was really interested in, media, of course, because my parents use it as a teaching tool. And so the really two main archetypes that really shape, like, I see them and I'm like, this is how I want to be. I want to grow up and be like this, were Suge Avery from Color Purple. That was, and we could also say Jack Kay's character in Women of Brewster Place, but namely Suge Avery in Color Purple. I really heavily identified with her. And I know that when I was a little kid and I first saw the movie, I was supposed to identify more with Celie or more with Nettie or more with even Sophia, in terms of, and it wasn't that all those characters were somehow disempowered or weak in any sense. They were multidimensional and complex. This was makes such a genius work. The reason why I liked Suge was that Suge is this literary character that is basically existing during the turn of the century and doing exactly whatever she wants to do. So she dresses in any old kind of way. She, hits on men in any old kind of way. She doesn't care if those men are in relationships, committed, married, whatever, right? It's about her own pleasure and it's about her own power, right? So Suge is a figure who finds empowerment in her sexuality, empowerment in her aesthetic, her musical ability. The fact that she can sing and woo audiences is very empowering to her. And she was irreverent, right? So you had everybody in the town, namely Mister's father, who talk, cad shit about her and say, she look, she black as tar, legs like baseball bats, I hear she's got the hand, I try to basically disparage her name and it doesn't stop her. It doesn't stop like the naysayers. And I mean, at the turn of the century, we didn't have the term haters, but this is essentially the community that Suge is in there's a lot of policing on her identity, starting with her father, who's a preacher, starting from this church community that she's excommunicated from because she sings worldly music. And then other women in the town who are envious of Suge because they have adhered to all of these rules and expectations of respectability just to have their men be attracted to her, who's not doing any of that, right? Who's living very unconventionally. And, and of course there's the queerness too, which I see in her and Celie's relationship and their desire for one another. So I'm like, oh, that's me, So like, she was a hero. I just said, oh, I just love this character. And it just, I know for my mom, it was ironic because again, Suge is not supposed to be a character that you aim to be. You love her. You love the fact that she's this really confident maverick in the book as well as in the film, but it's still her tale is still told as a cautionary one that, you know, and, you know, at the end of the day, she's a maverick, she's confident, she's working against the grain, she's unconventional, but that also invites this deep and profound sadness and emptiness and loneliness in her life. And so that's the part that of Shook's character that I just didn't identify with. I'm like, this is one of the freest characters I've ever seen. But at the same time, her freedom is the thing that makes her feel isolated, alienated, and sad, right? And that's because she's existing without a community of comrades who actually see her in the same way. She doesn't have a community. And so that was what she was missing. It wasn't that her freedom and confidence was the thing that made her lonely. It was the fact that she was without community. And then in the end, of course, she gets that community because she literally teaches others in the community to be free with themselves. And so her and Celie, you know, so she frees Celie up. So she creates her own community of, you know, mavericks, you know, just from being who she was. And so I just saw her as such a powerful and unique and interesting figure. And I just said, oh, I that's, if I'm going to grow up and that's how I want to be. And then the other one was Lourdes Afrikete, who was an explicitly queer literary figure. And in some ways, many theorists argue that Afrikete was actually Lourdes herself, in the sense that Afrikete is such a well-known literary figure that if a real Afrikete existed, I mean, I would think that she would like at least try to get the bag, at least try to secure some of the points. Like, that was the other figure. So one was in literature, one was in film, and neither one were actual and real. These were characters out of kind of Black feminist imaginations. I mean, Alice Walker and Lord. But nonetheless, I really overly identified with them to the point where I felt like this is how one should be. This is how one should feel. If one is grown and an adult, they should be able to feel as free as possible, despite racism, sexism, and all these things. Because I think that the issue with constantly talking about oppression in the lives of Black women is the fact that we're so much more than that, and that we have been able to create avenues of freedom and joy for us. And even, you know, as you mentioned, like when I think about beauty shops and when I think about Black women in kitchens together cooking meals and talking shit about the men in their lives as well as their own kids and together, you know, to commiserate about racism and inequity at the same time laughing about those things and forming community with one another. And so that's what I think, that we've always had private revelries of freedom and joy and pleasure, and they're in our lives and we're so used to them that we don't even see these as justice spaces. We don't see kitchen tables as justice spaces or beauty salons as justice, but they are. But and they've been, I mean, this is where Black women get to take off all the other kind of armor they have in the larger world and be able to be with each other in these real naked, you know, emotionally naked ways. And no one is privy to that. White people, men, Black men, you know, even Black children, you know, hey, adults is talking in here, gone, you know, so it's all, they're not even allowed in that space. So the space in and of itself is sacred. Yeah. It's
it
for
is.
Certain ideas, you know, for certain identities to be there. And to be able to be free enough to talk candidly. And we recognize that if men are in the room or children are in the room or lovers are in the room, that that's not gonna allow us to truly be emotionally naked in the ways that we need to, in the ways that we need to, you know? And so when I think of those things are all around us growing up. And once we become grown, we recognize how sacred those spaces are. When we're kids, we just feel like, oh, we're shut out and we're not allowed to, you know, and probably whatever they're talking about is boring anyway, you know, but it's not, it's not. I mean, we've carved out those spaces for centuries. Even when I think about, you know, a lot of times when we go down to Lexington, me and my wife, Missy, and she comes from a huge family, the Jacksons, and the way that they commune with one another. And so one time we went down there just for a house party her cousin Nika was having, and then her niece Shay, Missy's niece Shay, was like, you know, Auntie, I want locks. And so Missy's like, okay, real quick, let's do some locks in the middle of the party. Yeah. You know, so Missy starts Shay's locks in the middle of a party, and just the intimacy involved in the emotional connection and intimacy and Black women doing and donning one another's hair. You know, I want some cornrows real quick. I'm gonna call my girl because I want to wear this wig tonight and I can't cornrow my hair. So even those kinds of things. And the fact that we're sensitive about our hair. We don't let everybody and anybody touch our hair, do our hair, put their hands on our hair, because our hair is seen as something that's sacred. Whether we ourselves are natural or whether we have perms or whether we have wigs, we're still very like, you don't get to touch my hair, mm-hmm. and you don't touch my hair. And mm-hmm. I don't have a specific beautician, or I've been going to Miss Sally or so-and-so for years. So that, even that is very much, we control that, those things. So we, Black women have always been aware of, I think, at least intuitively, without theoretical interventions and all this, experientially, we've always been aware of the power we hold with one another and with ourselves. And we've been very diligent about creating boundaries where other people who are not us, they can't access those spaces, and they're not allowed in those spaces, and we don't want them in there. And we make it pretty plain that you don't belong here, you know, with different ways that we do that, you know? So yeah. I think that those things, all of those things together growing up, helped me formulate a type of freedom that most folks feel like, oh gosh, you know, DocuSoFree and stuff like, and I, to me, there's just no other way to be. And I feel privileged in that way, because I did not have those constraints. And I say privileged because even though I'm Black and I'm a woman and I'm queer, I always, always have felt free. In spite of all those things, because I didn't come from a family or parents. And I, like you, I wasn't churched into mm-hmm. respectability. I didn't come from any kind of restraint. I didn't even get no whoopings and nothing. I mean, I got timeouts and like, go to your room. And but I mean, so I never felt like whoever I was or however I was, that my parents, and because I'm the only child, I don't have siblings or anything, but if my parents accepted who I was, however I was, then that's all I needed. And they always, I mean, I don't know how they even dealt with half of the stuff. I dyed my hair, like crazy colors, and all my piercings in high school. I mean, they just were fine with that. They were in awe of like, this girl is just herself. And they loved authenticity, they loved the freedom, and they never tried to silence it or suppress it or tuck it away or anything. And that to me is why I say privilege, because that is a privilege. I don't think a lot of folks get that. They don't get that they have parents and communities and institutions have specific investments. And the specific investments in Black women are so deep. Mm-hmm. A lot of ways, the investments on suppressing Black women and who they are, Black girls and women and who they are, is much deeper than even the suppression of Black boys and men in those ways. So mm-hmm. it's something that we constantly have to work against as individuals and as a collective. We constantly have to work against those constructed social and cultural mores of expectations of how we're supposed to be, how we're supposed to carry ourselves, how we're supposed to everything. We have to work against that, you know, because if working against that is the pleasure.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
I'm Nubia Bennett, and this is Sprinkle Sparkle.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
You are listening to Sprinkle Sparkle Podcast, and I am Nubia Bennett, and we are talking to Dr. Kyla Story.
So I'm really excited to see just that irreverence that you said we pull even from queer folks, right? Because you're saying queer folks have just recently been invited into these conversations too, because it was just talking about Black feminism has always been Black feminists, even though that's not, Black queer women have been leading this charge the whole daggone time anyway. But thinking about everybody being irreverent. I mean, girl from the hood, Shaniqua from down the way, it's like, yo, I read books. She's like, oh, I read books and I like other Black women in whatever way you want that to mean. Or this lawyer, you know, saying I'm going to take some sexy pictures and they might end up on the internet, but so what? And it's just like this irreverence. I feel like that's the difference. I think that's what I keep coming back to, because we've always been holding space. I'm trying to figure out, I guess you can help me more with this. We've always held space, to your point, with each other. We've always had the hair salons, we've always had the kitchen table, and because oppression is multi-layered, we be in the kitchen table with our lawyer auntie and our cousin that works at the fast food joint, right? Or doesn't have no job and got 20 daggone kids, right? And then that is the same room. What's the difference now? Because we see it now and people are irreverent. They're like, I don't care. Maybe it's me. Maybe it's you. Age. What is it? Am I being clear about my question?
Yeah, okay. No, really, really clear. I think that we've gotten over time, like when I think of like decadent irreverence, I think of like Lil Nas X, for instance. So Lil Nas X as a young gay man and entertainer has chosen to use his visibility and his platform to bring up the most scandalous and sensational imagery surrounding queerness and Blackness in that intersection. And he's doing it completely on purpose. I mean, it reminds me of Marlon Riggs has a quote from his essay. Marlon Riggs is a gay Black filmmaker. He did Color Adjustment, Tongues Untied, Ethnic Notions, Black Is, Black Ain't. I mean, profound documentarian. And he wrote an essay called Unleash the Queen, where he was talking about how problematic it was to only show gay Black men in certain ways, unpartnered, as histrionic, flamboyant, these kind of tokenized ways that they were seen in media in the early 80s and 90s. And he starts off with saying, gaze upon this deviant, you know, like gaze upon this deviant, fixate upon this deviant, this defiant, right? And so he's kind of playing with defiant and deviant simultaneously. And I think this is what Lil Nas X does, right? So homophobes think that queer people are hypersex and therefore problematic. Lil Nas X says, yes, I'm hypersex and I live. And being hypersex is empowering. And don't you want to feel free sexually, right? So it's almost as if he's speaking to the homophobe in a way that makes the stereotype appealing and makes it an entryway into acceptance. I think this is why Lil Boosie, the rapper who's constantly trolling him, is so unnerved. Mm-hmm. What Lil Nas X is doing is one, making Black queerness visible, but also making it desirable. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, can't stop watching Lil Nas X. I mean, he just can't stop doing it. He can't stop obsessing over it, right? And this is what Lil Nas X is doing on purpose. And so all of the videos, like they show these kind of quintessential gay scenarios of like locker room homoeroticism and eroticism on the football field and men who desire other men, but who don't take queerness on as an identity and don't own queerness. My identity, right? So he's doing all those things. And so like, I think of that when I think of this kind of irreverency. I also think of Janelle Monáe, right? Who's not out, like who hasn't like really done this kind of declarative statement, like I'm queer or this, but is known to been in, you know, partnerships with like Tessa Thompson and other folk. And then also the fact that she identifies as a cyborg. Right. And says, you know, get your laws off my areola. Right. Like in the sense that my body and my sex is not for your capitalist white supremacist consumption. Mm-hmm. My desire isn't defined by what you see as desirable. You know, and in fact, I'm not even a human being. So you can't you can't deconstruct me the way that you construct a human being based on these racial or gendered stereotypes, right? I'm a cyborg, I'm an alien, I'm something from another world, another planet. And I think that the upsurgence of Black artists who do these kinds of things, and who use the kind of histrionic, flamboyant, I'm irreverent, I'm defiant, I'm unconventional, and I'm relishing in that. I think it's so great for young people who are formulating who they're going to be in the world and how they're gonna be in the world, to see someone like Lil Nas X, to see Janelle Monáe, to see someone like Meg Thee Stallion, right? Who at the same time that she's twerking, she's also enrolled in school. And
she graduated this year.
She graduated 2021. Yeah, so that's like a big commitment, because what she's doing is she's really challenging our assumptions about what it means to be an intellectual. And that is a type of freedom. And I mean, as you mentioned, like going into spaces with your different colored hair and say, well, I actually have my hair this color on purpose because I'm in this really conventional, restrictive space. And so I'm going to show you through that kind of aesthetic. And I think that gagging people in conventional spaces is the best feeling too. It's one of my favorite things to do. People assume you to be a certain way based on how you dress.
Yes.
Your aesthetic is, and then you're like, oh no, I have a doctorate, or I have this, or right. And so they gag, right?
I love it.
They become wildly uncomfortable.
Oh, yes.
They wanted you to be the stereotype that they had already formulated in their mind. They didn't want you to exist outside of that. And so that's a type of justice and resistance too. And I think that people want Lil Nas X to be a certain way. They want Janelle Monáe. They want Meg Thee Stallion to be a certain way. I remember when WAP comes out with her and Cardi B, and people are like, oh, I mean, this is not good for young girls and young girls to see this kind of, and I'm like,
and why not?
What is the not good, right?
Right, tell me so I know.
Yeah, what is the not good, right? The nudity, the sexual freedom,
right.
The focus on consent and agency, the empowerment. I mean, so for me, that's what I was seeing in the song, in the video. But for others, again, it's that policing. It's this idea that if you're a Black woman in the public sector or in the public sphere, your identity has to be digestible and is something that people can consume. And if they can't, they don't know what to do with you. And then make them angry. Mm-hmm. I think this is why folks get so mad at folks like Meg Thee Stallion. They get so mad at Lil Nas X because they cannot box them, and they cannot
see
them as these rudimentary subjectivities. They're not subjectivities that are static or restricted in any way. Mm-hmm. So you don't know what's going to happen next, and you don't know what they're going to do next, right? And that type of freedom. And so I think that younger generations of folks are really moving us forward in terms of thinking about Blackness outside of an A, B, and C framework, and thinking of queerness outside of those same frameworks. And the thing that I enjoy the most, for instance, about drag and viewing drag, is because it literally shows the audience that these confines of gender and race and sexuality are things that are literally projected on the human bodies. Mm-hmm. And we have the potential and we have the power to do and be anything we want. And we just, and drag does that as an art form, as a queer art form. It allows for you to come as anybody and transform yourself into anybody, right? And so it's a wonderful thing. I mean, especially when folks who live more conventional lives see a drag queen and say like, wow, she's so gorgeous, or she's so beautiful, or she's so sexy, or gosh, I feel like she looked better than me. I mean, and all that kind of stuff. It's basically saying that our imaginations have much more agency than our actual lived lives. And if we tap into our imaginative potential, we really can tap into a type of freedom for ourselves. A type of that we haven't thought about yet as a possibility. So if other aspects of your life can't have that freedom, we have the freedom of our bodies, of what to do with those bodies, of how to be and live in those bodies, and about what those bodies can represent to other people. And there's so much potential there. And I think that racism and sexism, homophobia, all that shit just limits the imagination. And that's what problem, you know, I mean, in addition to the legalized brutality and all of that, it limits the imagination and the potentiality of possibility models. So, you know, for young people and for people who are formulating, this is why, you know, dress codes and hair codes in schools, this is why those things are so problematic, because they limit the imaginative potential for young people. Young people are in a space in high school where they're trying to figure out who they're going to be and how they're going to be. And if you tell them that wearing your hair this way or dressing this way is not allowed, disallowed, and in fact, it makes you a thug or criminal or problematic, or, you know, then it limits the imagination of, you know, how I can see myself eventually as an adult and what that adult is going to look like for me. It limits that.
And we've talked about community, but what role do your interpersonal relationships, like, we know that this is good for your academic, but like making sure that you're centering pleasure in your families and with your friends, what does that look like? Is that different than what you're doing with your academic relationships? I mean, even though I know that there's a lot of overlap with that, but is there a difference for you?
Yeah, I think that even with my friendships, like, what's funny is, so I'm like really into eating. Like, food is a form of pleasure for me. I love eating. And I love to eat and like watch like different things. And so Missy will say, my wife says it, Jay, you know, my co-host for my podcast and my best friend, Jason Gardner. And same with my—
who I love also. Yeah, yeah. Who I love also.
My other best friend, Rebecca, who I've known since I was 16. They all know Yaba. They all talk about how, Kyla, I just can't hang with you because all we do is just lay down and eat and watch TV show after TV show and movie after movie. But I'm like, isn't that the ultimate fun, right? Isn't that the ultimate relaxation and decompression, you know? And but all of them are really much more mindful than me about eating and like health stuff. And I've gotten, as I've gotten older, yes, certainly, like, my stacks have gotten more like chocolate covered pretzels as opposed to stuff like that. But nonetheless, I still relish in that. I've developed it as something as a kid. It's particular to, I think, my mom, because that's how a lot of us, a lot of our time spending as a kid would be. Like, we would go to— my mom was really into craft shows. Oh my God. So we'd go to craft shows and then we'd stop by like Pizza Hut and then have like this good pizza. And then we'd go and watch like Lifetime movies together. And that was sort of like, oh, that was like the best time. And it was so much fun for me. And so it was a way that my mom took every single day and weekend that we had with each other and turned it into like a celebration. And there was no there was no cake, but it was almost like the Lucille Clifton poem, you know, come celebrate with me, you know, tried to kill me today, so come celebrate. And it's like that. And she's still like that. I mean, my parents retired and now they live with me and my wife here in Louisville. Oh. We're gonna have them do their own apartments and stuff like that, but it's just the apartment rent is like maddening, you know, and for their retired salaries and stuff. So my mom had the idea for us to get a big enough house for all of us to kind of live freely together. And she still does that now. Like, we feel like, tonight we're having wine. And this is her exact voice. Tonight we're having wine because it's a celebration. And I'm like, why is it a celebration? And I'm like, why is it a celebration, mom? She's like, because it's Tuesday. It's celebrating.
I love it.
Oh my God. I mean, this is exactly how she is, this Black woman. It's cracked my friends up, everybody. But this is exactly how she talks, how she is. Her disposition is overwhelmingly always been sunny and excited. And there's a part of me that's my personality. So every day is a celebration, every moment.
I love it.
We're together and alive and healthy. You should relish that and be excited. And so that's what I try to do with my friends. That's what I do with Missy. I mean, those are my favorite ways to spend time. Like, Missy's always like, you don't want me to take you out nowhere, baby? And I was like, I don't want to go outside. I don't want to go outside. I like to be in the house because then I don't feel like I put on, you know, I love feminine artifice. I love makeup. I love lashes and all that. But it is a type of drag, right? And so for me, the girls, you know, drag queens call it peeling out of drags, right? So like, for me, my ultimate, like, you know, intimate, you know, emotionally intimate way to be is out of that, is to be peeled, to be washed face, to have my glasses on, I mean, you know, and smoke my cigarettes and lay down and enjoy the company of my wife and my puppy and my parents.
So hearing your mom celebrate, tell your mother she's in my pleasure lineage too. I think I might have met her at the wedding, possibly, maybe, but she's in my lineage now too, because it's celebrating because it's Tuesday is a beautiful gift that you have given me today. Because when I leave here, they're like, why are you celebrating? Because I had an hour and a half to 2 hours with Dr. Story. And it's Saturday, the end. And that's it. And letting that period at the end of the sentence is just, that's it. That's the sentence. It's like it's Saturday.
Yeah, that's it. It's Saturday. It's Monday. I mean, you know, and she would always do that. She would call my phone. Because we've lived apart for 20 years, where I've been in different cities, where I left Michigan, you know, when I was 18, I lived in Chicago, and then I lived in Philly, and now I lived in Louisville. And so for 20 years, we would see each other maybe once a year, sometimes lucky twice a year on vacations, like for Christmas or holidays and stuff like that. And so, yeah, to have that celebratory daily salute of excitement back in my life every day is great. So, you know, I always wake up with an attitude. I'm not a morning person. I'm not into it, you know, and, you know, she's like, good morning. And she's like, happy Monday. Today is Monday. And it's wonderful. And we're going to celebrate. We're going to celebrate tonight with wine. And like, she loves wine. And I'm like, I'm not really a big fan of wine or anything like that. Like you know, bourbon, stuff like that. But she's like, you can have your bourbon and I'll have my wine. And we're doing a celebration. And she'll tell Denver, the puppy, you know, Denver, we're celebrating because it's Monday, you know. So I wish I was like making it up. It cracks me up. And in fact, I don't know if you remember Perry Green.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I had told him about that, about my mom early on when we met, when he was at U of L, and he, every time he saw me, he'd be like, hey doc, happy Monday.
But did you discover anything new, or did your pleasure practices change with the pandemic, did anything change?
Well, what I came in tune with, well, because I was teaching online during the pandemic, and we were also doing the podcast for the first year of the pandemic, we were doing that online as well. I started walking around my neighborhood, walk my puppy, and then I would drop him off at home, and then I would continue to just walk around my neighborhood. It provided me with a lot of peace and silence and quiet. And because most of the time before the pandemic, if I had downtime, I would just like get on social media, right? Get on Twitter, get on Instagram, get on Tumblr, you know, and that would bring me pleasure too. But then even that started waning, because a lot of folks during this pandemic, everything was so incredibly devastating. Everything was so incredibly sad. So anytime I went to my go-to with social media, everyone was sharing these like sad stories about loved ones COVID or loved ones getting positive, you know, from COVID, and you know, the hospitals collapsing, and I mean, just like everything was so devastating. I mean, there was virtually nothing positive or empowering. And so I just started walking and taking in like fresh air. And I was up to like 3-4 miles a day where I would just go and walk, because I had just all this time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I, you know, TV was getting boring, and I didn't want to start binge watching a show or something, you know, and get into that. And so I started walking. So that was one thing that is a new thing that I've kept. And I know we're still in the pandemic, but I've kept that up. And I really, really enjoy it. And now I feel like I almost need it. I needed to clear my head. I needed to have my thoughts. I needed, I like that. I like the indulgent part of it, right? It seems like, oh no, it's healthy and stuff, but it is, it's indulgent. It's that I get to be with my own thoughts. I don't have any kind of outside, nothing. I don't have my phone with me. I don't have anybody talking to me or trying to influence me in any kind of way. It's just me and my thoughts. And I really like the freedom in that. So that's one thing. And then I've gotten into like glasses. Like I found during the pandemic that there's all these different types of glasses that I didn't realize that I could do, because I've worn glasses since the fourth grade. I've hated them. I hate glasses, you know, on my face. I really, really don't. I've never enjoyed them at all. So I've always worn contacts since the fourth grade as well.
Fourth grade?
Everything was on Zoom all the time. You know, I got these lashes. I got these contacts. My eyes would be so dry just from being on Zoom and being like, you know, having to make eye contact for that long. And so I'm like, child, I got to figure out something, you know, because in the glasses that you get at the regular eyeglass place were so like boring to me, and none of them were festive, and I have a really bad astigmatism in both eyes. And so Now you have all these new companies like Vogue Me and Zelly or whatever.
Zillow or something like that. Yeah,
they have all of these really loud, bold glasses and frames. And they're really reasonable. And all you need is your pupil distance. And if you call your eye care provider, they'll give you that. They won't put it on your prescription though, because that's the shade. They know that you can go and find your frame somewhere else. And they're more festive frames, but that's why they won't put your pupil distance. And that's just the distance between your eyeballs. They won't give it to you. But if you call them, they'll give it to you over the phone. They'll give it to you in person. You just have to ask. And then you can get all kinds of things. I mean, these frames are only like $19. And even adding the prescription in them, it still is ridiculously cheap, much cheaper than going to your eye doctor. And so I have like 6 different pair. And I started using them. And so it was a way to, so my eyes aren't dried out from my contacts in a meeting, but it was also a way to still be festive and be kind to my eyes. And so that's something that's new. So now I'm constantly surfing the sites for new glasses. Like the
And I love the ones you have on right now.
So much fun. And so, I mean, those are the things. I mean, the walks and the new glasses fetish, those are some things that in response to the pandemic that I've incorporated into my kind of like practicing pleasure day, you know.
Yes, it's good for you. Yes, it's, you know, quiet. Yes, but it's indulgent because it's what you want to do. And that, I think, is why it's accessible, because it doesn't have to look, and then it takes the value out of how extravagant it is, because your walk is free, you know, your water bottle might cost something.
It doesn't cost money, and nobody can bother me during my walk. Like I don't even take my phone as a way of that, right? Because you can't control others around you. And like, but for me, like if I get, you know, and that's again, the Capricorn in me is if I get email dings to my phone, if I get texts, like I have to respond, like I don't like notifications to stay in my phone. So that's like, I have an OCD part of me that's like that, but that would be disruptive to what I'm trying to manifest in the walk. So I don't take my phone with me and I leave it here. So then when I come back, then I can deal with those things. But I literally try and use the walk as a way to shut everything out, to shut out student demands, work demands, even my household demands, right? So if my mom wants to say, oh, Denver's doing this, like when I'm walking, I don't care what Denver's doing. I don't walk is about me and this is my time, right? So I don't care what he's doing. I don't care if Missy's still in the store. I don't care about none of that. Like this is about me communing with myself, seeing nature. I love like animals. Like I've seen a fox on my walk. I've seen deer. I've seen, and I love to see animals like in their natural environment. So like those kinds of, you know, and the thing I do hate is that I never take my phone. So I never get to capture, but at the same time, it's like my experience just for me and myself. And so, yeah, like we got to create those boundaries in our lives where it is just about us. And that is not selfish. Almost every other identity in the world gets things to be about them, whether that's legally, socially, or culturally. And Black women are the folk who almost never get to center their needs or wants or desires in intentional and consistent ways. And so they might have, you know, they have these she sheds now, or they might go on a girl's trip. But these are seen as moments, as every now and again things that they get to indulge in that the others in their lives who depend on them for emotion or money or stability, they allow them that space to indulge within themselves, right, for that those moments. But there isn't this consistent thing that they're doing in their lives that brings them pleasure and that's just about them. And I think that's important for Black women specifically to think of things that are accessible to them, that are just about them, and where they can focus on just them, their wants, needs, desires, thoughts, just for themselves. And that can be a walk, that can be anything that they want. That could be listening to music with your headphones on, even if your household is in chaos or going crazy, right? But just to take those moments and turn them into a consistent practice that allows you, you know, that allows you the freedom to just focus on the things that you need, you want, and give yourself that clarity. And I think that it's not indulgent. I think that it's necessary.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that just, and then of course, now I can't unsee this idea of Mama Story saying, because it's Tuesday. Like, I mean, for real, like, I mean, I'm going to have like this imaginary meme in my head with your mama in it. That's like, should I do this? And I'm like, absolutely. Cause it's Monday. Yep. That's it. That's why. And that's it. And I'm so.
Missy's always like, well, why are you celebrating? Cause she'd be like, hey, Missy, cause my mom will come down to the kitchen and we'll be in the kitchen. And she'd be like, hey, Missy, hey, Denver, hey, Kai. And we're like, hey, mom. And then she'd be like, well, tonight I'm going to have vodka instead of wine. And we'll be like, well, why are you having vodka? And she's like, because it's a celebration. And she's like, I went to my doctor's appointment, or I got my teeth cleaned today, or Kai retwisted my locks. So she started locking over the pandemic. And I love that it made me responsible for the retwist. Exactly. Just another form of, you know, so she'd be like, Kai retwisted my locks, so I'm feeling extra beautiful. And today is Wednesday. And so, you know, so yeah, like, you know, so she's going to, my mom is going to have her celebratory drink in the evening every day, especially now that she's retired and she doesn't have to like get up on a Monday or worry about work or anything. And she was doing that even on the weekends when I was little. Then it wasn't alcohol then. Then it was like macaroni salad or cookies from the special cookie store or something special, like, or pot pies from our favorite place that made pot pies. It was always a special item, or it was a special drink item or a special food item. And we had to celebrate because it was just a regular day. So she's like,
I tell your mama I love her from where I am. Like, just to say, Nubia said, okay.
I still love that.
Beautiful. I think that is the most beautiful thing I have ever heard. That has made my whole Saturday for sure. So, but then I'm gonna ask you, right? Because we've been up in the sky, we've been just looking at the world. What are you gonna do today that is gonna center like your pleasure? In whatever ways.
Well, today I plan on accessing all the different streaming services that I subscribe to now, like, and try to find a movie. My wife Missy she's going to get a tattoo today, and so she went to go get a tattoo for her granny. Her grandmother died, I feel like, in January of this year, and so Missy has about 9 tattoos already, but. Like, this is like her 10th tattoo. And
this is her pleasure praxis, okay? She's like, give me the ink.
And I'm like, I don't have any tattoos, and I don't know. I've never gotten a tattoo, and I'm terrified of needles. So even though I had lots of piercings, I have my nose pierced. I used to have my eyebrow. I had my labrae. I had my tongue. Mm-hmm. My ears were like all the way up. Because it was quick, the needle would be quick.
That's true, right?
Whereas tattoo, it's like can't do it. I'm so terrified. So she's going to get that as her pleasure practice. Mm. And then I think we might get Indian food, which is our thing together. Both love Indian food, especially marsala. We get the shrimp marsala from that, what is it, Kashmir?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's Kashmir on Bardstown. Oh my God. So again, it's going to be the same thing I usually do. She's getting a tattoo. I have this interview with you. And so then after everything's done, we'll get Indian food and watch something on one of these streaming services. That's my favorite thing. And then just like cuddle and snuggle with Denver, because he's a beagle. So all he does is basically eat and nap. So he's the perfect dog for me, because he loves snacks and he loves naps and lay down and stuff like that. So that's my plan. So today, I plan to do that. So I'm excited about that. It's like,
that's a beautiful day. Hopefully did you get your walk in today? Cause it was lovely.
I got it in and I'm loving this weather, because for the last couple of weeks we've had these scorching temperatures and I can't stand hot. I mean, I can't take it. And so this fall crisp air going on. Yeah. So I did my walk already And
it was beautiful. I sat out in it earlier.
Yeah, so it's nice. It was nice today. And I just love when I get to walk without, where it's not too cold, so I don't need a heavy coat or a jacket.
Yeah.
And then also, I hated walking when it was really, really hot, because then I'd have to walk in like, you know, really like short shorts or something, you know, and then that just invites mosquitoes. And then that just like, so that's
so you come back mad. They'd be like, yeah. No, like, oh, supposed to come back refreshed. You're like, I'm hot.
Yeah.
And then you got mosquito bites.
And you walking by and people mowing the lawn and you got grass because the baby oil on your legs. And now you got grass all over your legs. Like, oh my God. So that's why I don't like walking.
Got you. It makes sense. Yeah. You know, I'm a sensitive summer thing, like Nero Wahid said. So I'm like, how dare you disrespect summer like that? Like,
I get it.
It was a nice, lovely morning, afternoon, morning-ish. I sat in a hammock chair that I put up on my balcony. So I'm here with you. But
yeah.
Good. I mean, I just want to tell you, I mean, and I feel like I've said this at every interview. I was like, this was as lovely as I imagined it being, but better. Because, you know, I mean, you know, I've been a Doc Story fan my whole, like, since August 2008. And I walked in with my pink shirt, my leggings, and like, I remember what I had on the first day of your class, okay? It's that serious. And you know, I could go on a whole long down a rabbit hole, but one of the things I just always say when I speak about you and to you, I think I say this every time, is that it's almost like when you're free, because you've been sitting, now I know more, right? Because I know you've been free your whole life, which I think is beautiful and intentional about it. And your parents were intentional about it. It got me rethinking my parenting at home. Like, what is this? Am I being intentional enough? I'm gonna go home and like have an interview with my son. Like, am I being intentional about you being free? Because I know what that looks like, right? But that allows, it makes me think of that Marianne Williamson poem. I mean, like her or love her or hate her or whatever, that poem or that quote she has about liberating others because you're committed to being free. That being a pleasure practice, right? And then passing that on to other people and then going to all Toni Morrison on them and saying, all right, so I've set you free. Now you set everybody else free. It makes you, you're creating this spider web that centers pleasure and studies it and elevates it in lots of different ways. Because I know other people who have been impacted by your work and the Pleasure Ninja's work, and everybody that comes from them is infectious in the better ways than Corona. Okay.
Yes.
It's infectious in a good way. And I'm really, really grateful for that. Because I know that I wouldn't, funny story, really random funny story. And this may make it on air or not. I don't know. I just remember you, I don't know if you remember the old time Facebook where you had the little, not Dr. Seuss, those little books, the with the little characters, the, not Dr. Seuss, I can't think of, like they would have Mr. Yes, or like these weird shaped, I'm gonna send it to you. I'm gonna find it, okay. I'm gonna send it to you. And like you tag people who is like Mr. Shy, Mr. Laffy or whatever. And so I remember you tagged me in the picture as like the shy one. And I was like, oh man, Dr. Story thinks I'm shy.
Oh no. But
I was like 2008. It was like, and I was going through a lot. Yeah. You know? But I think about that, right? And I think about how like 10 years ago, maybe, because I graduated with my master's in 2016 and I did it because I took your class. And I say that standing in that. And then I remember being brightly colored and stuff like that and starting to embrace those bright colors. And I think when I think about the way you tagged me and being shy, it was because I remember being, for the one of the first times that I remember, looking like, oh, she's her whole full self. And the only part about that makes me uncomfortable is that I must not be, like, I'm not owning all of the parts. Because everything you were doing was exactly what I wanted to do. And I was like, I'm wearing gray right now. Or I would wear a color, but I would be really nervous about it or something like that, right? So you were picking up on something, right? But then I think about 10 years later when I'm like working with students and I'm insisting on being like, no, this needs to be neon. Whether literally or figuratively, this needs to be bright. This needs to be vibrant. And this isn't just for me. This is for them too. So they can do it too. And you just, I mean, I'm grateful for you teaching me, you know, Black feminism and all of that, but I'm really, really grateful because you just existing in these spaces is your whole ass self. You have to use ass with that because it's just like, I'm my whole ass self. And insisting that, and even pushing, making people just uncomfortable who aren't being their whole selves, but not in a way that it's like, oh, because you're not good enough. It's like, because you just don't know yet. That's okay. You will. And how that's shown itself in me, and not just me, because everybody has a how I met that story. Like, there's a story for that. I like, pun intended. But I know I'm not the only one that's really grateful for that. So I just want to, you know, that, I feel like that's why you always hear that from me, because I will forever be grateful for that. And I know a whole bunch, I can throw a rock and hit 10 other people that have gone, experienced your classes or just listened to you talk or whatever and have that same story. So I guess I'm not that special in that way, right? But I do feel really special because you've given me this much time. And I cannot wait to see what comes out the other side of this. And just know I'm out here colonizing in the good way, just like you.
Oh, so. I just love that. Oh, I absolutely adore and love you, Nubia. And I hate that. I make you feel self-conscious that I made. But I do, I think that, you know, what I saw in you was all the things that you are now, bold, courageous, unapologetic. But you were trying to harness it then, you know, when we meet in 2008, and you're so young then, you know, but you were trying to harness it. You were trying to hide it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't want you to do that, you know.
You were like, absolutely not. No, no.
I knew you would feel like, well, I'm not shy and I'm very confident. I'm very vocal. And you were, but you were harnessing it. You were harnessing that energy that I knew was there. There was no way that you could vibe with me or vibe with what I was teaching if you were this kind of shy person. So it was, you know, I mean, and just to, over the years, to see all the ways that you've grown and declared and owned who you are. Mm-hmm. It's been a gift. It's just been a wonderful sight to see. I'm just so, and I say this all the time, I'm so immensely proud of you, but I literally am. I mean, in my bones.
Same. The feeling is mutual.
So I really enjoyed talking.
What did we learn? I hope you all had your notebooks out and were taking good notes, because I don't know. I feel like it's self-explanatory. I could have probably just started this conversation from the beginning without any introduction, and then it would have told you everything you needed to know. But like I say every single time, this was even more pleasurable than I imagined it being. I was super excited to have this conversation with one of my favorite people. And I hope she heard all of those favorites as she's listening. Beyond just the brilliance of the scholarship, because, you know, I get excited about the fact that there's even scholarship around pleasure as an act of resistance, and pleasure just as something that we deserve because we exist. I also really loved being able to take that conversation out of scholarship and into just saying it's pleasure because it's pleasure, period, with a T at the end, right? Because the conversation moved from all of this, you know, beautiful, wonderful scholarship around pleasure being a praxis and something that you just do and something that you can research and learn about, right? But like when she starts talking about, you know, her relationship to her parents and how they just accepted her for being as out there as she wanted to be, as exactly who she was, discovering who she was, and they just let her, right? That is an act of resistance. Just because you deserve it because you exist. Like, she existed on this earth and her parents were like, well, now you're going to read the books because you're going to understand why. You're going to understand why you get to just be out here just being yourself. But aside from that, she just was. And the pleasure in just existing. And I love the way she talks about her mom just celebrating because it's Tuesday. Like, thinking about, I mean, that is such a simple and a clear example of a very strong relationship with pleasure that doesn't require a lot of analysis. It's just like, today is Tuesday, so we're celebrating. I'm going to get the wine. I'll have my little drink, or I'll have my soda, or I'll have whatever the thing is that feels like a celebration because it's Tuesday. I'm going to dress up today because I just feel like it. Like, the idea that, especially the juxtaposition of a scholar, right? Somebody who studies this every single day, having the relationship to pleasure that does not require an analysis. It's just because it exists. So, like, the joy in ending that conversation with that, like, because it is, that is invigorating for me, and it's inspiring for me, because we're told every single day that we have to deserve it and that we have to work to deserve all of these things. And so, both in a universal sense, that to hear someone say that's not true, and this is how I'm living my life to show you that it's not true, but also to hear it personally for me from someone who I admire deeply and who I know has done the work and who I know that while walking into the classroom the first day I met her, she had her hoop earrings and her slick back dreadlock ponytail. And she was like, yes, hunty, I love your outfit. And it was just super casual and super just because I was there. But at the same time, has done the work for many, many years. It's like, again, living in this place where multiple things are true at once. Like, yes, do your work. Yes, take care of your responsibilities. Yes, know your stuff, right? And talk your ish if you need to, right? But at the same time, you exist on this earth and you deserve pleasure because you exist. Like, at the same time, I think as brilliant as the scholarship around all of that is, just knowing that we deserve pleasure because we exist on this earth, that's the point. And so, as usual, I'm forever, ever grateful for Dr. Story and everyone that I've had the opportunity to talk to this entire, at this point, year that I've been working on this project, because I've learned so much and I've asked the same questions over and over and over again. And the answers are so different, but they're the same, because what I'm hearing is that we deserve it because we're here. And it's cool to analyze it. It's cool to reminisce and reflect on what brought us there. But if everybody's answer is I deserve it because I'm here, then it lets me know that we're getting somewhere. So I'm just really grateful for the conversation today that I had with her, with Dr. Story, the Dr. Kyla Story. But I'm also really, really grateful for the journey that talking to these other 13 people, like the things I've learned from each of these conversations, because again, it's been very competing answers that all fit in this container of a relationship to something that we just deserve, that deserves to be complex too. So thank you. That's it from me today. Now I want to hear from you. How did you center your own pleasure today? Hit me up at sprinklesparkle.org.
Sprinkle Sparkle is created and hosted by Nubia Bennett and produced by me, Alex Biscardi. Our music is by Allison Cross, and Mindy Folner does our graphic design. Sprinkle Sparkle is part of the Louisville Public Media Podcast Incubator, with support from the Community Foundation of Louisville and the Eye Care Institute's Butchertown Clinical Trials. Our executive producer is Laura Ellis. For more episodes and to keep in touch, visit sprinklesparkle.org. From LPM, Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.